You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's back to school time, and we're going behind the scenes on school lunches and the people, politics, and policies behind them. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about being seen.
What's one of the best ways to combat hate? For Jesus Gregorio Smith of Appleton, it's to push back with love. He shares his story as part of the Home is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Latino residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
I saw the sign up on Richmond Street in downtown Appleton, and I couldn't believe my eyes. It was just a sign flashing the F word, the one that rhymes with maggots. It was displayed across a business sign so everyone driving down the road could see it like it was nothing. All I could think about was, how could this be possible? Those poor queer kids who already have a hard time with family, within themselves being gay or bi or trans, what happens when they see this sign spewing so much hate? I had to do something. I've experienced my fair share of hatred and bigotry throughout my life. I was born and raised in the little old town of El Paso, Texas. My father, Johnny Smith, is an African-American man who was born in the 1940s during legal segregation. While Dad was stationed at Fort Bliss, he traveled to Juarez, Mexico, with his fellow soldiers for drinks and fun nights. It's there he fell in love with my mother, Sonia Smith. Once they were married, they had 5 mixed-race children. I'm the youngest of the 5. I had the luxury and honor of having 2 cultural backgrounds and influences in my life. But that luxury also had costs. I recall the first time I was ever called the N-word, and it was by Mexican folks. And I thought to myself, don't we all have it bad enough? Why are we picking on each other? I'll never forget the time my mother gave me this serious talk in first grade because she was embarrassed with how feminine I was as a child. In fact, the first person to ever call me the F word was my mother. My father instilled a particular vision of Black masculinity that was meant to protect my brothers and I in the world. He stressed that I needed to get a good job in computers in order to be successful. As I got older, I hid my gayness and only pursued paths that would make my family proud, keep me hidden, and keep the comments about me to a minimum. But college didn't lead to a career in computers. Instead, I faced my fears and embraced my identity. I began empowering fellow members of the queer LGBTQIA community. Eventually, I got my PhD in sociology with a focus on race, sexuality, and masculinity. And that's what brought me to Wisconsin, a job at Appleton's Lawrence University as an assistant professor of ethnic studies. Which brings me back to that homophobic sign I saw in downtown Appleton. I didn't let the hate deter me. So when I decided to protest under the sign, I gayed it up even more to be exactly what the sign said I was. I put on a purple wig, a rainbow shirt, white high heels, and danced around to Born This Way by Lady Gaga. I filmed a silly video and took a photo. The photo went viral on social media. Not too long after, numerous Appleton residents showed up to fight against the hate, resulting in it coming down. I took that viral image, put it on a shirt, and sold it, and raised $15,000 for the Sexual Assault Crisis Center. That is how you turn that hate into love. Through the process of finding oneself, embracing oneself, living as one's authentic self, one can counter painful experiences and turn them into something different. I tried to hide myself from pain, but when I bravely faced it, I overcame it. It isn't easy, but I think we deserve to see a different world. Determining your own path, despite what others say, can help you break out of molds that confine you. I eventually embraced who I was and made a huge difference in people's lives, as well as my own.
Jesus Gregorio Smith is an associate professor of ethnic studies at Lawrence University. His story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made of 6 media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, kids are headed back to school in Wisconsin in the coming weeks if they're not back already. And we're paying a visit now to an often overlooked part of the school experience, the cafeteria. What's served in schools in Wisconsin, where it comes from, why access to good nutrition is not always equal, the workforce behind school lunches, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up eating school lunches? What differences do you see from when you were growing up and what your kids might see today? Do your kids eat school lunches or bring their own to school? Have you ever worked in the school cafeteria? Love to hear about your experience. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Gaddis is an associate professor of civil society and community studies at UW-Madison, and she sits on the advisory board of the National Farm to School Network. She's the author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
We've talked in the past, Jennifer, a little bit about kind of an unplanned experiment with school lunches that came about because of the pandemic. What kind of things have changed? What kind of things do you think we've learned from the pandemic era and how we changed our school lunch programs?
Yeah, I think that one thing that was really huge during the pandemic era is that we had this really wonderful experiment nationwide where we were able to offer free school breakfasts and lunches to all children, regardless of their household income. And that's something that from the very, very beginning of school lunch programs in the United States, dating back over 100 years, had been a dream of a lot of the people who created these programs. And the pandemic is something that really made it both politically and logistically possible for about 2 years. Since then, basically starting the last school year, families across Wisconsin, for the most part, have experienced a return to the pre-pandemic model where students pay for school lunch based on their family income. So for example, a family of four earning $39,000 or less in Wisconsin would qualify for free meals. Those in a family of four earning between $39,000 and $1 and $55,500 would qualify for reduced price meals, which cost 40 cents for lunch. But everyone else would fall into this paid category where the local school district or private school that's participating in the National School Breakfast and Lunch Program sets the particular prices at the local level. So we've kind of gone back to that old model in most all schools across the state of Wisconsin. But there's a lot of momentum nationwide to get the old model from the pandemic of free school meals for all back. In fact, eight states, including a few of our neighbors, Minnesota and Michigan, and actually Illinois is poised to be the ninth state, have passed state-level legislation that will guarantee students free school breakfasts and lunches into the future. So I think that it's something that has really sparked a national conversation and movement about why is it that school meals seem to be the only thing in schools that we actually treat as something that parents and caregivers should be paying for separately and differently based on their economic station. You know, you don't do that for bus rides, you don't do that for gym class, for English, for math. So it's sort of a weird exception. And I think that there's this growing movement now to really see school meals and nutrition as a necessary material resource for all students to really excel academically and just thrive in terms of mental and emotional and physical well-being. So I think it's kind of opened up a new conversation about what school meals are for and how they should be funded.
And you are working, I understand, on a study about how parents and caregivers feel about school lunches, because finances aren't the only factor. In some cases, you know, parents, even with free school lunch, don't go with it. What kind of things are you hoping to find out?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. So in some of the states that have begun to offer free school meals for all, and even in some of the districts in Wisconsin that offer free school meals for all through something called the community eligibility provision, we sometimes see that participation rates, you know, hover around 60 to 70%. And so it kind of begs this question of what else is going on. And on the one hand, I think that there are some issues with people maybe having misperceptions about meal quality. So I think, for example, I went to school in the 1990s. School meals are very different today than what they looked like when I was a kid. A lot of research studies actually show that school meals are the healthiest food that students actually consume. And even healthier on average than what parents or caregivers might be packing as part of a home lunch. So I think that there are some misperceptions about the nutritional quality of school meals. And I think also in some schools where they're not doing a lot of fresh preparation, which we often refer to as scratch cooking, I think that there's some concerns about food quality as well. And some of those things, I think, you know, can vary from school to school or even district to district in terms of, you know, how much the perception really matches reality. I think that there are a lot of places across the state of Wisconsin and nationally that have been doing really phenomenal work trying to transition to more scratch cooking and doing a lot of what we call farm to school, which means sourcing more food from local Wisconsin farmers and other producers, and also providing more educational opportunities for students around the food. So I think that there's a lot of things that have changed that parents might not be necessarily aware of, but I think that there's also still some struggles. So for example, you know, thinking about an elementary student, if they see that, for example, it's supposed to be grilled cheese and tomato soup on a particular day, and then the school has to do some sort of menu substitution, and then the child arrives and, you know, what they decided they were going to eat for lunch that day isn't on offer, and it's something that they don't like or don't feel comfortable eating. And so then they maybe decide not to eat school lunch that day. And then they come home, they tell their parents or their caregiver, you know, that they went hungry that day. That can be something that would make a parent feel, you know, guilty or worried or concerned that their child isn't necessarily being taken care of. So I think that there's definitely some issues in terms of just, you know, people really wanting the best for their kids, and a lot of trust that goes into really letting somebody else take on that role of feeding your child. But I will say, from my experience in school cafeterias across the state and really getting to know a lot of the really wonderful people who work in school nutrition programs, that they really, really care about the kids. And I think that the workers across the state would love nothing more than to be able to feed all students across the state free of charge and to have the resources that they need to produce fresh meals that students are really happy to eat and that parents feel really excited about their kids eating.
We're talking about school lunch and back to school season. Our guest is Jennifer Gaddis. She's from UW-Madison and author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Coming up, we'll look at who's making and serving these lunches, the conditions they work in, what they get paid. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever worked in a school cafeteria, maybe as a nutritionist, a cook, a part-time worker? Are you doing it? Are you gearing up to do it right now? Love to hear what you've experienced there, what you think maybe should change, what you wish people knew about that job. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with UW-Madison professor Jennifer Gaddis, author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. We're talking about school lunches and school cafeterias in the back-to-school season. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about policies, the projects that go into school lunches? Do you want to share your experience as a parent, a student, somebody working to provide these lunches, or maybe a farmer supplying schools? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer, let's talk about who is making these lunches. You've done a lot of research, including some out earlier this year, on things like pay for school lunch workers, school cafeteria workers. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, so we did a study that included about 25% of schools across the state of Wisconsin. And what we found out was that part-time workers make up the backbone of school nutrition programs across the state. 4 out of 5 non-managerial employees work part-time hours. And most of those jobs are what we would consider to be poverty wage or low wage jobs. But there has been some increase in terms of what wages look like, particularly in this last kind of 2 years as schools have been transitioning back to in-person schooling and to this new real competitive you know, marketplace for different kinds of employees. But we have definitely found that there's a pretty significant wage gap between people who work in cafeterias and kitchens in our elementary and secondary schools versus, for example, retirement and assisted living or medical facilities such as hospitals, even though a lot of the work is actually quite similar. And I think one thing people don't necessarily understand about school nutrition workers is that they're not only preparing and serving food, but they also have to understand a lot of different regulations coming not only from the federal government, but also from state and also like from the county and even local district wellness policies. They have a lot of things that they have to kind of keep in their minds in terms of different paperwork and requirements. They have to be able to follow food safety protocols, accommodate special diets, and they also have at least 4 and up to 12 hours of continuing education that they have to do every year to satisfy the federal government's professional standards. So there's a lot that goes into the work that I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize. So part of the challenge, I think, is to help people understand that this is a profession that deserves respect and that people oftentimes are actually taking a pretty big hit to their annual take-home pay just because they really care about the kids that they're feeding and want to work in a school setting. Another thing that we found was that this is a very gendered workforce. So over 90% of the workers in school nutrition programs in the state of Wisconsin are women. And if we look, for example, at the difference in pay between school nutrition workers and custodial workers, who most often are men, there's a pretty significant difference in hourly pay. So I think for a variety of reasons, a number of school districts across the state are really trying to do what they can to increase workers' wages, because if school nutrition programs can't actually recruit and retain enough employees, that has a really big impact on the quality of the food and the quality of the experience for the students that they're serving.
And looking at that report, Jennifer, I want to key in on that turnover issue. That report, you talked to a lot of supervisors, and they said, yeah, I lost 4 or 5 out of my 10 staff this year. This is a problem.
Yeah, and I think that school nutrition employees usually are the lowest paid or tied for lowest paid in a school system. So one thing that a number of the directors and managers that we spoke with for this report would say is that it almost seems as if people from other departments in the school are actually coming and poaching workers from my department to serve as like paraprofessionals, for example, or student aides. And so it can be really difficult for them to not only be competing with private sector jobs, but also to be actually retaining their employees even within the school system. So it's definitely something that I think is a big issue. And another thing that we found was that a lot of the workers in school nutrition programs on the money that they take home, they really can't even afford housing. So a lot of employees actually have 2 or even 3 jobs. And that's something that I think is really exacerbated by the fact that most schools have their employees in 9-month contracts. Mm. So it means that not only are you having part-time hours at low pay, but also you don't necessarily have guaranteed work during the summer. So it can be something that is very challenging in terms of school districts really being able to make sure that they have the staffing that they need. So that's one reason why in some of the states that have passed what's called Healthy School Meals for All legislation, they've actually included provisions to really direct additional money towards workers' wages and compensation, as well as workforce development to make sure that people are trained to do fresh cooking and to use more local products.
Let's bring on a caller. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Liz?
So I worked in Georgia as an SNP for 5 years, and it was during the time that Michelle Obama had started the My Plate initiative with the fresh foods coming in. I liked it because it helped the farmers bring in more products to us. But it also, I worked in poverty level elementary and middle schools. We also had to teach classes to these children about what these fruits and vegetables are, how much you should eat, the My Plate situation and everything, because they had no idea. They had never seen certain fruits or vegetables before when we would put them out on the line. And so they wouldn't take them. So then we would have to turn around and do a class and teach them what it was, how much you should eat, and what, you know, what was good for them.
Liz, interesting perspective. Jennifer, in just our last minute or so, when we make a change in our nutrition programs, how to bring the kids themselves on board?
Well, I think that definitely that education piece is a big one, but also I think that giving the opportunity for students to have more input in designing menus is a really great strategy. So for example, in Madison, where I am at East High School last school year, one of the culinary classes actually worked with their teacher and with the school district to develop some new recipes that they taste tested with students in their high school. And then the recipes that were most popular were actually integrated into the regular school cycle menu. So I think that definitely the educational piece is important, but also really making these programs more participatory and giving students more voice and certainly saying that things need to be healthy and to meet nutritional standards, but there's a lot of different forms of healthy food, right? And there's a lot of ways that students might be able to get input in terms of what they would really like to see. And for the most part, with the work that I've done in school districts across the state, we really hear the same thing time and time again, that students just want to have fresher, higher quality food. So there's certain things that I think are definitely popular in schools that we don't necessarily need to change, but it's more about making sure that the food is a little bit fresher when it's served and that students do have access to things that are reflective of their cultures and what they're eating at home as well.
Liz, thanks for the call. And Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Jennifer Gaddis, Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison. Jennifer sits on the advisory board of the National Farm to School Network, and she's the author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. She joined us for a behind-the-scenes look at school lunch programs. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's a lot of need for professional workers in senior care facilities. A project in Eau Claire is working to give people the training they need to do those jobs. We'll meet the organizers. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin meteorologist gives us the latest on hurricane season and the storm heading across the southeastern United States right now. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this morning, Hurricane Idalia made landfall near Keaton Beach, Florida, as a Category 3 hurricane with 125-mile-an-hour winds. A couple hours after landfall, the storm remained as a Category 1 hurricane and started heading toward Georgia and South Carolina. Hundreds of thousands of homes in Florida and Georgia are without power at this point, according to AP News. Idalia is the biggest storm we've seen this year in what's already predicted to be an especially busy Atlantic hurricane season, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Our next guest is a hurricane expert here in Wisconsin who's been watching this storm closely. Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's great to talk to you.
We've heard this called an unprecedented event, the way this hurricane has hit, where it's hit. What stands out to you, John, about this hurricane?
Yeah, so first, if you can picture a map of Florida in your head, there's a transition area between the Florida Peninsula, which is, sticks southward, Tampa, Orlando, Miami, and the Panhandle, which is kind of that northwestern kind of panhandle. And it's an area that the Gulf Coast, called the Big Bend. And generally, we can get a lot of strong hurricanes, say, in parts of southwest Florida and eastern Florida and into the Panhandle of Florida. But we haven't had many at all go into this Big Bend region. That's this area well north of Tampa and well east of, say, Destin and Panama City. And so this particular hurricane, being a Category 3 at landfall, was the Big Bend's. It actually tied for the strongest hurricane on record by wind speed, and that tie was from 1896. So, this is a pretty unusually strong hurricane for that Big Bend region.
Remind us what makes something a Category 3 storm and what other factors go into determining how destructive a hurricane can be.
Sure. So hurricanes are categorized based on their winds. 1, 2, and 3, that's based on the maximum sustained winds that a hurricane has. And in this particular case, it actually reached Category 4 intensity just before landfall, and then it weakened a little bit, broadened its wind field a little bit, and it was a Cat 3 at landfall. So that's all based on wind speed. But a hurricane is much more than winds. And frankly, some of its more deadly aspects are from water, not wind. So storm surge, this is the push of water from the ocean to the coast. And we saw storm surge inundation of up to 8 feet along parts of the Big Bend coast this morning, say around the town of Steinhatchee, Florida. So that's a storm surge. And then you have the danger from rainfall flooding. We've already had some reports of up to 6 inches of rain in parts of Georgia. And now as I'm looking at radar now, we're having heavy rain in eastern Georgia and parts of the Carolinas. So hurricanes are categorized by wind, but they're also dangerous because of the water, both from the ocean and also falling out of the sky.
The storm Idalia is moving over, as you said, Georgia, then the Carolinas, then out into the Atlantic. There were some points where there was a concern, I think, that Idalia could potentially curve back and hit the southeast U.S. again. What are the projections at this point?
Yeah, that was some interesting forecast model solutions we had yesterday, showing this kind of this clockwise loop back toward Florida. Well, the latest forecast models aren't showing that much at all now. We're expecting Idalia to be downgraded to a tropical storm at some point later today. It'll scrape the Carolinas through, say, Thursday afternoon, and then eventually it'll just kind of move slowly out toward Bermuda this weekend, and it'll just kind of sit out there for a while and eventually start to drift back toward the northeast. So we don't think there's much of a concern. We can't completely rule it out just yet, but we think the chances of it looping back toward the U.S. at this point are very low.
Talking to Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com, looking at Hurricane Idalia going through the southeastern United States right now and hurricane season in general. John, this idea of rapid intensification, it seems like with a lot of our big hurricanes over the last few years now, that phrase has come up. What are we talking about when we talk about rapid intensification?
Yeah, it pretty much is as it sounds. It's a tropical storm or a tropical depression that just undergoes really fast intensification. Meteorologists say if it increases its winds by 35 miles per hour in 24 hours or less, it's considered a rapidly intensifying storm. And, you know, when I first started getting into this about 25 years ago, rapid intensifiers were pretty infrequent in any year. They were really notable when we got one. And now it seems like I can't see a hurricane that doesn't rapidly intensify. So we had Idalia. We had another hurricane, by the way, out there between Bermuda and the East Coast, Hurricane Franklin. That also rapidly intensified. And we see a lot of rapid intensifiers out in the Western Pacific. They're called typhoons out there. And that's basically because there's a lot of moisture in the atmosphere and there's very warm water and there's very low wind shear. So when that happens, these tropical storms and hurricanes can intensify quickly, and that's always a bit unnerving, especially when they're near landfall.
I've actually wanted to give you a call for weeks now, John. I keep reading about a heat wave, a marine heat wave in the waters, especially around Florida, not just there, though. And I've been wanting to ask you, how much could that affect hurricanes? How much does that raise the risk of things like rapid intensification?
Well, it certainly raises the risk. I mean, that's the main fuel source for tropical storms and hurricanes is deep, warm ocean water, which then transfers to the air and makes the air warm, sticky, and humid. And that's what you need to generate thunderstorms, which are the building blocks of hurricanes. So that is our big concern for the rest of hurricane season, is that it's not just the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, the Gulf of Mexico is record warm in July, basically still near record warmth, if not record warm for this time of year now. You have all this reservoir of warm water, and all it takes is a storm to sit over that warm water. As long as it doesn't have shearing winds over the top of it or dry air, that storm could go pretty quickly. So that's a continued concern all the way through the end of hurricane season, despite the fact that we have an El Nino in play, which usually puts the brakes on our hurricane season.
I also wanted to ask you about this Hilary storm. Usually we're talking about the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico when we talk hurricanes. Well, this is the southwestern United States and Baja California in Mexico. How unusual was that?
Well, it's not unusual to have remnants of tropical storms and hurricanes come out of the eastern Pacific. So that area, say, west of the west coast of Mexico, and then eventually get pulled up towards, say, the desert southwest, parts of Arizona and the deserts of California and Nevada and so on and so forth. That usually happens at least one or two times a year. Mm-hmm. But what's unusual about Hillary is that it was pulled up unusually far to the west, such that it was still a tropical storm when it was over Southern California. In fact, one of the more surreal things I saw out of Hillary's when the tropical storm was actually centered right over L.A. And that is exceedingly rare. And it pulled all that rain right over the L.A. basin and then into the deserts of Southern California. So that is extremely rare to have a tropical storm still classified as a tropical storm over Southern California and the L.A. basin.
Bringing things back to today's news, John, a hurricane, Idalia. Now, it went from a Category 3 at landfall down to a Category 1 hurricane. It seems, from my hurricane memory, and you'll know better than I do, it seems like it maintained hurricane status further inland than this usually happens. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Rob, that's a great point to make. So sometimes what will happen is a hurricane is moving so fast. I mean, it's now currently moving at 20 miles per hour, which is pretty fast for a hurricane. That when it makes landfall, it just doesn't, if it's moving faster, it doesn't have as much time to slow down, you know, wind down and weaken. So you get these hurricane force winds pushing farther inland for a faster moving hurricane than a slower moving hurricane. So that's what we saw with Idalia. We had some, you know, gusts over 80 miles per hour in parts of North Florida and, you know, some stronger wind gusts also in South Georgia. So occasionally when that happens, we can have a hurricane hold on to its status a bit longer than it normally would once it's away from the ocean water.
And briefly, John, a bit of good news maybe. Slower moving hurricanes may dump more water on one particular spot.
That can be good and bad news. You know, if you're in a drought, you like the good soaking, but it can be a bad news case. If it's a slower moving hurricane, it can produce flooding rain pretty quickly.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That's Wisconsin's own Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com. We've been looking at this year's hurricane season and the latest updates from Florida and now Georgia and the Carolinas, where Hurricane Idalia made landfall earlier today. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Recent polls show more and more people question the trustworthiness of their media sources. Journalists are trying to rebuild that trust, especially at the local level, but a lot of smaller media outlets are struggling to stay afloat and produce quality reporting with declining revenues. Our next guest researched new ideas to help reporters and editors engage with their communities and strengthen their relationship with their audiences. Susan Robinson is a professor of journalism at UW-Madison. I recently talked to her about her new book. It's called How Journalists Engage, A Theory of Trust Building, Identities, and Care. Here's a listen. There have been a lot of conversations about declining trust in the media. That's a part of the focus of your book. And can you start us off by defining what you're talking about when you say trust in the context of journalists trying to rebuild it?
I'm so glad that you're asking me to nuance that, because so often when we ask people, hey, do you trust news media? People think about cable pundits, right? Mm-hmm. And they think about national news and they think about all of the misinformation that's swirling out there in lots of different circles. But what I'm talking about here really is more about local news. I'm talking about trust in your local reporters, trust in the news as an institution, but I'm also now talking about trust as a relationship that you may have both with the content that's happening about your news and the things that matter to you, but also the individual reporters who are out there producing it every day.
And a lot of your message is for somebody who's operating, publishing, editing, or reporting for some kind of local news outlet. What are some first steps that they can take to, I guess, do a trust inventory to see how much collateral they have with the communities they're out there covering?
Well, one of the things that I do is called applied research. So I work with organizations that work with newsrooms. So Trusting News, Harkin, Solutions Journalism Network, these nonprofit agencies that go in and help newsrooms think about engagement with audiences in much different ways than we used to think about it. And so what this book does is it documents this giant, massive retraining that's been happening over the last 10 years around engagement journalism, moving away from sort of this source-driven content and more towards developing relationships in different ways with all kinds of communities and all kinds of people. And so one of the things that this book has in the conclusion, of course, we have to have recommendations in every conclusion, is for journalists to think about how they're trying to reconfigure those relationships and their very specific suggestions.
Yeah, can you give us a couple of those? What could they in local media coverage be doing?
Sure. So one of the things we've been doing a lot of over the last 2 years is asking journalists to conduct listening sessions with people who are not engaged with their brand. And so with the journalists that we've been trying to do this, we did 87 conversations. About half of those conversations were with people who identified as right-leaning and were completely distrustful of the local news brand. And the other half were with BIPOC groups, Native Americans or immigrants or African Americans. And what we found was that even after 30 minutes of being listened to, and often these transcripts, by the way, were full of sort of anger and vitriol and just a lot of fear about journalism. Even after that 30 minutes, we asked these community members, hey, like, what did that conversation do for you in terms of trust building? And 87% of those community members after this interview said, yes, actually, this little 30, 40 minute session where I didn't allow the journalist to get a word in edgewise really built trust, not only in the journalist, but also in the brand. And more startlingly, more than a third of them said they would consider subscribing, which is huge, right? And so what we're trying to do is how do we scale that, right? Because it's really hard to have those kinds of sessions with local and mid-sized newsrooms that are just already so constrained.
Now, let's talk about those constraints. I imagine a response you'll get from somebody at a local paper, and I feel this here in broadcast too, is this all sounds great. I've got a deadline. I've got a show to do today. I've got three articles and then the web treatment and so on so to do. When do we find time to do that kind of outreach that doesn't help me meet that deadline?
Yeah. And I should say that I was a journalist for a long time before I became a journalism professor. And I so feel that. And journalists today, they have so many financial pressures, but also more and more physical pressures, right? There's more and more violence against journalists, even in the US these days. They're doing really heroic work, I think, out on the front lines in all kinds of different situations. So we try to break everything down into little nuggets, little snacks of change, so to speak, because nobody can change everything that they do in the next couple of days, right? So for example, we look a lot at word choice and the kinds of terms that you use in headlines or you use in leads, which is the first sentence of any news article if you're in print. Checking in with people in the newsroom and trying to figure out like what kind of individuals do we have that are represented right here, not just racially or politically, but do we have any veterans? Do we have religious people? Do we have people who own guns? In order to understand all of the dimensions of difference, not only of how we're covering something, but also that are represented in all of our communities.
We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professor Sue Robinson. Her new book is called How Journalists Engage, A Theory of Trust Building, Identities, and Care. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, for the most part, I just don't trust the media, local media as well. I've been involved in open records requests with our school district. I've had conversations with reporters. I've seen them distort story after story or not report stories that were of interest to the community. The only thing I would say to everyone is be your own fact checker. Do not trust any individual source. Always ask the question, how are they trying to dupe me into believing their side of a story?
And Steve, before I let you go, I don't want to put a label on you. What would you consider your political perspective if somebody made you put a label on yourself?
I am a libertarian.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for calling in. Sue, do you have thoughts for Steve and maybe for a media outlet, whether it's, you know, they've got the 2 days a week paper or the Sun Prairie Star and Sun Prairie, or a Madison-based outlet to reach out to someone with Steve's perspective?
Yeah, and I think we hear that perspective more and more, especially as we have all of these misinformation bots and we have all of these players in the game who are intentionally trying to throw information chaos into our public deliberation and our discourse. And so that's a tall order. And one of the things that we suggest is massive radical transparency so that every single story, particularly, for example, the K-12 school, anything about the school districts that you have next to your story or embedded within the story, all of links to information, links to the evidence, you know, all of that together. And so that's just one of the things that we need to be doing these days, just because of the state of the institution. I will say that I think journalists, local journalists, particularly those who are writing for the papers that you mentioned, are very, very trustworthy. It's just that there's a grand narrative that's out there right now telling a story that, you know, these reporters are out to dupe them. That's not, I have not seen that. And I've been doing research for about 19 years now, where I'm actually asking journalists, talking to journalists, surveying journalists, focus groups with journalists. I just have not seen that local or mid journalists or even national journalists are out to dupe anybody. I think that what's happening is there's a massive restructuring that's happened in the industry, and journalists are being asked to take on 4 or 5 jobs. And so they're not able to be at every single school board member meeting like they used to be able to. And so what we're just suggesting in this retraining that I document in the book is that they sort of shift their priorities and stop doing stuff like the meeting stories and doing more different kinds of engaged work that is operating from within community rather than without.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Sue, can you point us toward somebody you think is getting it right, whether it's a project that's working across multiple newsrooms or a particular media outlet where you're seeing them do stuff, they're building that trust with their community, and you think they're getting it right?
I mean, honestly, public radio across the nation and even Wisconsin, they've been doing it right for a long time. A lot of our nonprofit agencies and doing right. And Madison's lucky enough to have a saturated media city. And I know personally a lot of the journalists who work at the Isthmus or the Wisconsin State Journal or the Milwaukee Journalist Sentinel or, you know, Channel 3000, Madison Magazine. All of these organizations are doing it right. It's just that circumstances right now are really difficult. They've lost out on their 3 major tiers of revenue streams. So they're trying to figure out a new business model, even as the information needs of audiences have changed. And so one of the things I'd like to ask is for people to be patient and to also to follow the models of, for example, public radio, where they're reaching out to different communities, building trust in different ways, you know, trying new things, experimenting, and some of those things are going to fail, but, you know, it's the only way that we're going to continue to have local journalism survive.
And you know, just our last minute, thoughts for when the newsroom in some significant way is different than the people they cover. That could mean a mostly white newsroom covering a community of color. It could mean, you know, news industry concentrated in the city and they want to do a good job covering small towns and rural areas. Can you leave us with some thoughts on how to bridge that gap?
Right. We work a lot with Trusting News, and they have a project called Dimensions of Difference that you can just Google and look at all of the different kits and the guides that we've helped them come up with. And then we evaluate them and then we tweak the guides. And those help journalists understand what their differences are. They help them figure out like what questions that they can ask. They help them learn how to identify and then create relationships with different influencers on different kinds of platforms that represent the differences, the perspectives that they're missing maybe. And so I would point people to that.
Sue, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Susan Robinson is a professor of journalism at UW-Madison. Her latest book is called How Journalists Engage, A Theory of Trust Building, Identities, and Care. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.